Hi guys, welcome to another episode of Gold Bazan. Today we're going to be discussing, doing pretty much a preview and then hopefully going to do an analysis with the great. If you guys know Scott McIntyre, you know his great work with Asian football. And also, Scott will be talking about the Asian Games podcast, which is following alongside a colleague of his, Paul Williams, which is another great football journalist that in regards to Asian football. And then we have our very own Sinai Simeon of Gold Bazan. Guys, different parts of the world, and Scott is talking to us all the way from Japan, seen all the way from the UK, and myself in the United States, unfortunately. How you doing, Scott? I mean, it's morning from your end, midnight.
Very good, Sinan Pasha. It's a real privilege and an honor for me to be on with you guys. You do fantastic work for Iranian football, but more than that as well, you know, Asian football, and everybody that's interested in it's a fantastic resource, part of a pool of, you know, great podcasts and websites that exists across Asia, and you guys are at the forefront of that. So yeah, congratulations and keep up the good work, because I know how hard it can be at times to keep doing this kind of thing. You know, you often caught by a lot of grief from people who don't agree with certain aspects or whatever, but yeah, it's a wonderful resource.
Oh man, I really appreciate that. Thank you very much. And how are you doing today, Sina?
I'm very well, thank you, Pasha. It's great to be on again. I mean, it's been a while since me and you have been on the same pod, so yeah. Of course, it's a pleasure as always to be speaking to you, and of course, it's a pleasure to have Scott as well. You know, he's been a friend of the pod for a long time, of course, as you know, and I'm really excited to be educated by him ahead of this massive Champions League tie.
No, exactly, and this is why we're going to have Scott on to pick his brains about Kashima Antlers right now, actually. Scott, obviously, your work has, you just pretty much know everything inside and out, being very well connected with everything that is happening. As you can imagine, probably even goes for Kashima Antlers, even their fans, or just, you know, the J-League fans, and then from our end, Iranian football fans that watch it, we might not know much about Kashima Antlers, we just might have heard about them, and vice versa. Could you let us know about, you know, how they got to the final? What is their situation like? I know they're a powerhouse, but if you could just give us a little bit of an in-depth about Kashima Antlers, we would really appreciate it.
I think what you said is exactly right, and this is one of the problems that we have, and maybe we can talk about this a little bit later on with the Champions League in general, in that, I mean, even, I don't know what it's like so much in the West, but certainly here in the East, I mean, you know, if you talk to someone from Uzbekistan about an Australian club, or someone from Japan about a Thai club, and you know, and on and on and on, and there's really, I guess, little knowledge or understanding even of what the domestic situation is like in those leagues, let alone the fact that when we stretch it right across, you know, to South Asia and certainly up to the West. So I don't know how on earth we're going to kind of solve this problem and bring everyone back into the one happy family. But you're absolutely right in what you said, that, you know, if you spoke to, I think, the average Japanese fan on the street, they might not even know that the Champions League is on, although now that Kashima are in it, they might. But, you know, if you said to them about Iran, maybe they could name, you know, the two historical big clubs from Tehran in Persepolis and Esteghlal. But outside of that, they'd struggle to, you know, to identify which one's red and which one's blue, and, you know, name names and all this kind of stuff. So I understand, you know, equally from the West, that that Kashima is a bit of a mystery as well. The whole club is actually a bit of a mystery, that it even exists. I mean, the actual region where it comes from is, drew it on the map, maybe only 100 kilometres outside of Tokyo, so maybe a bit over that, but it's very much a rural area of farmland. I took the train out there for the first leg of the semi-final. Most people take the bus from Tokyo, which takes it's still a long time. It can take you 2-3 hours on the bus, but the train, it took me 4 or 4.5 hours kind of meandering. You know, it takes you an hour to get outside of the metropolis of Tokyo, and then you're slowly into the farmland. There's trains stopping at random at places along the way. There was one train station literally in the middle of two kind of rice fields on either side, with no discernible reason why it would even be stopping there. And, you know, so this is the kind of place, the prefecture where Kashima is based. And when the J-League was formed, I mean, they were next to no chance of even getting a J-League license. I think the guy that was in charge of the licensing system at that time said they've got a 99.99% chance of not getting in, but they've got strong local backing from the community, a very strong government backing, and a little bit of finance and support. And then, of course, the whole thing with Zico coming to the club. Yeah, I guess against all odds, they got this J-League license. And then from then, they've had a very deep connection with Brazil and Brazilian football through Zico. I think they've only on very few occasions had even Japanese coaches at the helm. The majority of the time they've been led by Brazilians, almost always their foreigners are all Brazilians, often quite the good ones, as we can see with this squad as well. I've got a couple of really good Brazilians, but since then they've gone on to become a powerhouse of the game. I mean, they've won more league titles than anyone else. They've won a lot of League Cup titles, Emperor's Cup titles, have a lot of players coming through the youth academy into the senior setup, and it's still against all odds that this kind of story is happening. And then I think everyone knows what happened a couple of years ago when they reached the Club World Cup when it was here in Japan and made it all the way to the final, where they pushed Real Madrid right until the end of that game and arguably had the better of that game for long periods as well. And I think for a long time we've seen Japanese clubs perhaps not, you can say, take the ACL as seriously as they could have, and they should have. And indeed, we saw that this year with a couple of teams, Cerezo or Osaka in particular, that for some reason only known to them, would consistently send their B team to all these kind of away matches in the ACL, and were thankfully bundled out at the group stage. And Kashima have on occasion been like that when they've been in the ACL in the past, but I think it really kind of hit home, you know, the success that they had in the Club World Cup and wanting to be back on that stage. I think as much for the Japanese clubs, as much as winning the ACL is a big honour and a big thing, you know, for now we don't know what's going to happen with FIFA and all these myriad new tournaments that are, you know, reportedly sprouting up. But for now we've got at least one more Club World Cup, and I think that as much as winning the ACL on a standalone merit is an absolutely, driving a force for Kashima. They put a lot of resources into it. They brought Zico back out to Japan. Actually, he's been in the country, I think, for the past 2 months now, kind of traveling up and down all around the country, watching games, making kind of scouting reports and analysis on the squad for them, which is a little bit ironic in the way that he had a reputation when he was actually the Japan national coach of not famously traveling outside of Tokyo. So he's probably done more traveling in his time now in the last couple of months back with Kashima than he has when he was in charge of the national team. But it shows the lengths that, you know, they're prepared to go to make sure they have a success in this tournament. The J-League has been accommodating in, of course, it's the end of the domestic season here. There's only four matches to go in the J-League. So, you know, they've had a lot of fixtures rearranged, a lot of midweek matches. And in fact, they've pretty much since the end of the World Cup break played three games a week for that whole time. So you're talking two and a half, almost 3 months now of three matches a week. So you would think it would lead to burnout. There have been a few injuries in the squad, I guess probably partly as a result of that. But, you know, they're really doing all they can, to try and make the final, which they have, and now go on and make sure that they win it.
Well, that's fantastic, Scott. Thank you very much. Sina, I'm now coming back to you. Before, obviously, we get in the gist of talking about Shimans, could you tell us about, you know, you watch Paris Bodies in the Iranian League. Let the listeners know about, you know, how, you know, Bronco and his team got here and the work Bronco has done, which he's pretty much been a revolution between Paris Bodies. If you could just touch base on that for us.
Sure. I mean, it's a very, I'm not a Paris Bodies fan, but it's kind of heartwarming to see the club having gone through so many problems recently to have such a fantastic achievement and reach the final for the first time in their history. And this is a club that has had some of the best players in Asia play for them. And to be honest, we both know they've probably had better teams on paper, but yet they were not able to reach this stage ever before. They had the most appearances in the Champions League semi-finals without ever making it to the final. So for them, it was really about breaking that duck and really pushing themselves further to reach that stage. They managed to reach the semi-finals last year, this time last year, and they played against Al Hilal of Saudi Arabia. But in the second leg, they got absolutely thrashed 4-0. And on paper, they probably had a better team than they do now in terms of personnel. Yet, here we are talking about Paris Police in the final. And some of the challenges that Bronco has had and Paris Police as a club that they've had to deal with, there's been plenty. And some of, I mean, the main one probably is the fact that Paris Police are currently having a transfer embargo. I think it's two transfer windows that they were unable to buy players, and it's from the time that Mehdi Taremi left the club to join the Turkish club by the name of Rizespor, and he broke his contract after only a few weeks, and re-signed for Persepolis, which then brought the consequences and FIFA banned Persepolis from being able to buy players, and this had knock-on effects as well. After the World Cup, a few players left the club on a free, such as Vahid Amiri, and they were left really with a very thin squad, and his ability to really get the best out of the resources that he has and the players that he has is absolutely fantastic. And I always go back to Branko Ivankovic's time as Iran manager in the 2006 World Cup, and you know, the amount of criticism towards him was so bad at the end of that tournament, where he didn't return to Iran from Germany with the team. He stayed in Germany and went back to his homeland in Croatia. So one of the points of criticism towards him in that tournament was the team not being fit enough, always running out of fuel in the last 15-20 minutes, you know, going back to the games against Mexico and Portugal in particular. But I think that's one of the things that's been I think he kind of learned his lessons, let's just say. And then the fitness coach Marko Stalinović, which Pasha, you've spoke to almost all the coaching staff at Persepolis. Mm-hmm. They've done a fantastic job fitness wise. I mean, Watching the games, not just the second leg against Al Sadd, but generally every single time they've played in the Champions League, knowing the thin squad that they have, knowing that they don't really have many options coming off the bench to change the game or even a fresh pair of legs, the same quality of the ones already on the pitch. To be able to get those fitness levels up to the level that they are right now is a testament to the fantastic work done by Branko. And they've won the league twice in a row for the first time since 2000. There's so many records being broken, and it's a fantastic achievement for them. And again, very similar to Kashima, they're one of the big teams domestically. They've won the league so many times, yet that Continental Trophy has kind of eluded them. And in terms of motivation, I mean, Scott spoke about Kashima wanting to play in that Club World Cup. That's where their ambitions are. They've played in that mm-hmm. tournament before, and they want to get there again. For Persepolis, the obsession with and the motivation to win that Continental Trophy is kind of different to that. I mean, of course, a majority of people would know about the rivalry between SLL and Persepolis, and the fact that SLL have won the Champions League twice in their history. So Persepolis fans, as you know, the fans and the club as well, they've had to deal with that taunting and with that pressure that, you know, your main rivals have won this trophy twice, and it's about time that, you know, Persepolis, as a big club that they are, they need to achieve this as well. It's a massive task at hand. I would probably say Kashima are favourites for the final, but again, it doesn't take anything away from Persepolis and what they've been able to achieve in these past two or three years under Branko Ivankovic.
Scott, I really want to hear your thoughts on Persepolis. Obviously, you know, you've been such a world traveler for football. You've been to Iran, you know, Iranian football from back of your head and everything. And I just want to add that during the summer when I was in Iran, I sat down with Branko, I had a chat with him, and as soon as I brought up the question of why Iranian clubs struggle, I will never forget the way he laughed, and he said he could write a book on it. And now to see this man has made it to the final with, you know, obviously with Sinan pinpointed, you know, with the transfer ban, you know, and how he advocates for some of his players to, you know, go to Europe. And I believe he's even helped, like, Mladen. I mean, one of our former players that when he was playing now in Croatia, he was a big, Branko was really a big advocate behind that when he was telling me before leading up to it. But could you tell us about Persepolis and just, you know, and fans that are listening to us, what they could expect from the Azadi and whatnot?
I don't know if I'm the best person to answer all of those questions, to be totally honest. But yeah, as you said, I've been to Iran twice. Once I was actually deported on arrival, so I didn't see that much. That's another story for another day. But on the second time, I went in when I was working with Guam, and we had the really the joy and great privilege of going to the Azadi, because it's one of them, as you guys know, but I think as all Asian football fans know, it's like the Holy Grail, right? I mean, it's one of the, you could say, three or four most kind of storied venues in Asian football, if not indeed beyond that. So for me to be there, it was was a hell of an experience, a spine tingling kind of thing. Even the crowd wasn't totally sold out, you know, when we played, but still there were a lot of people there, and you got the sense of the atmosphere inside the venue. And you know, we've all seen what goes on, you know, with the derbies and how difficult it is for people to get in. It's obviously worth pointing out here again that we'd love to see women allowed into this venue, as should be the case throughout the footballing world. And, you know, that's a decision now that the AFC will have to take a stand on, as was the case when Western Sydney went to Saudi Arabia and made that a bit of a point. I think you could probably expect that to be an issue that's going to be talked about quite a bit in the build-up to that second leg. And we hope that women certainly are allowed into that venue, as they should be. But, yeah, as you said, you know, overcome the odds, really, in this year to be where they are. And I mean, Iranian football, in a way, is similar to Japanese football. I don't know off the top of my head, but I imagine that perhaps only Korea would give these two nations a run for their money in terms of the players that they export you know, across to Europe, particularly a lot of good young talent, which makes the league, you know, regenerating the league a priority. And so, you know, it's great to see that it's still, you know, with these restrictions, particularly in the Iranian case, you're not only losing players, but, you know, in this case of Persepolis, you're being forced to deal with the squad you have in terms of you can't make, you know, changes to it as well. Let's just see, you know, how that story plays out in the long run here over these two legs of the final. But I think it's a great thing. It's a dream final in many ways. You know, a major power of East Asia, of Japan, who's never made it to the Champions League final before, up against, you know, one of these, again, clubs in a very similar situation in Iran. The fact that the second leg is scheduled to be played in Iran, I mean, it's everybody's dream, right? I mean, surely it's the AFC's a dream. It's a match, I think, that will, you know, capture the attention, not just of people within Asia, but hopefully, you know, people beyond that as well, because, you know, the crowd is going to be there, the atmosphere, even, you know, watching that second leg game on TV, you know, the constant noise that comes, you almost can't, you know, I mean, when the first goal went in, you didn't know what was going on, but suddenly the crowd is just silent, and then, you know, a minute or so later, they're back up and singing again. So the stage is certainly set for a fantastic match between, you know, these two clubs, and then it comes down to tactically, who's going to get on top? I think I agree with Sana that the Kashima probably, I think, should be the favourite across the two legs. For me, as fantastic a story as it is, and certainly a coach that I respect very much in Branko as well, for me, tactically, there's still a little bit of an unusual side. And I hold my hand up and say, you know, I don't watch every game they play, but certainly on the evidence that I've seen in the Champions League, they play a very narrow, really, in midfield. I mean, you have this kind of flat back four, and then you almost have a kind of three blocks of two, you know, the two sixes, if you want, two eights or two tens, and then the two central strikers as well. And I mean, you saw how they got caught out for the first goal. I mean, they're narrow going forward, but they're also narrow defensively as well at points. And so if you can get the ball quickly out wide and then back in, there's a lot of space to exploit, as we saw Al-Sadd do that very effectively for that first goal. So this is something that I'm sure Kashima will have watched. And if you try to play centrally through a team such as Kashima, I think you're going to have far less joy than you've had up to this point in the tournament, because that's really the great strength of their side. A young Japanese international, Kento Misao, one of the greatest foreigners, in my opinion, that's played here in a long time, in the Brazilian, Leo Silva, fantastic central midfielders. And I think you'll see the wide guys that drop in and you know, really work to cut those spaces off. So it's going to be interesting to see how Branko approaches things tactically, how the Kashima coach, Gowoiwa, who we should point out has only actually been coaching for, I think this will be his third season now after being promoted midway through the campaign when they failed to actually get out of the group stage into the second round a couple of years ago in the AACL. The previous guy was sacked and he was brought in. He's done a fantastic job since then, but he's still, you know, in terms of, if you compare the coaching experience with Branko, very much a novice in that regard. But, you know, I think tactically there's certain areas there that Kashima can look to exploit, and I think they will.
Right. Scott, before I you came to the next...
Sorry, Porsche, just... Yes. I wanted to make a really quick point on the back of what Scott said, and you mentioned something really important in terms of the tactical battle of the game. And you know, he mentioned something very important, that the way the Persepolis play, and they play with a narrow diamond, which is the reason why they lost so heavily to Al Hilal last season in the semi final. And what Al Hilal did was they managed to actually add the fullbacks to the wingers, support them on wide areas, and get the crosses into the back post, which basically is how they scored the four goals in that I think it was the first leg, if I remember correctly, which is what Al Sadd couldn't necessarily do in this game. But I would give Bronco the benefit of the doubt to say he learned from his mistakes last year. But Persepolis will be very predictive in the way they play. They will not change their shape. They will not change their formation. They will stick to the narrow diamond with the two strikers, mostly because, of course, the lack of personnel, but also it's a formation that has been working for two seasons for Persepolis now, domestically, and, of course, now in the continental stage as well. So it'd be very unlikely that Bronco will change that shape for the two games, but it could be a point where Kashima have the upper hand on Persepolis.
So, that was my next topic I wanted to talk to you guys about, which you guys just pinpointed a little bit about, is tactics. So, if you could just a little bit talk about what do you expect, how Bronco is going to approach this game, with the players you think that potentially we start. And also, I have a question for you from Twitter, which I appreciate, from @TheFireBoat. He mentioned that it's remarkable that this Persepolis team won drain of almost all its talent when most quality players have left the Iranian Persian League, is the one to finally make it to the ACL final. Bayram Van is a legend. Do you think he's getting enough credit, or are we still romanticizing past players?
Well, I think in terms of the players that are available for the final, I think the main player that will be missed, and he was sort of missed in the semi-final against Al Sadd, is the vice-captain of the club and right-back, Hossein Mohini, who's had a cruciate ligament injury, and he will be out for 7 to 8 months, unfortunately for him. And the usual right-back that was there last season, Sadio Moharrami, as you mentioned, he's gone to Croatia to play for Dynamo Zagreb. So they are left in a position where they are without a recognised right-back. Now, we saw Shahrekh Khalilzadeh, who is a centre-back, playing that role against Al Sadd, which against Akram Afif as well, of all players in Asia. And I don't think he did a very good job. And I think that is one of the weakest spots in the team now, and one that Kashima certainly has to aim for if they are to get a result against Persepolis. We saw Mohamed Ansari playing centre-back with Jalal Hosseini, the veteran. He's still playing at a high level, but I think the ones around him really need to help him out. And because, of course, he doesn't have the pace. He was never a pacey defender anyway, but now certainly at the age of, I think he's 36, 37, he certainly doesn't have any pace. So the ones around him certainly need to help him out. Bayram Van is probably the unsung hero, if I may call him that. And it's mostly because, as you mentioned, a lot of players left during the summer. Vahid Hamiri went to Trabzonspor, Sadiq Moharrami went to Croatia, Fashid Ahmadzadeh to Poland, and of course, Mohsen Mosalman, who had his problems with Bronco, although he was still a very key player. But he left the club. Bayram Van, in spite of the great performances in the World Cup and the offers, multiple offers that he had from Europe, he said, "I'm going to stick with Persepolis until at least January, until this transfer embargo is over." So he's been loyal to the club, and he pulled off two or three fantastic saves against Al Sadd to help him reach the final. He will be key as well, because, look, in the big games he does show up, in fairness to him, but he does have his moments of madness, let's just say, where he does make the odd decision here and there and could turn out to be costly. I'm hoping that's not the case. But he will be a key player as well. If I'm correct, he's one of the players nominated for the Asian Footballer of the Year. He's had a fantastic year. It would be brilliant for him to top it off with the Asian Champions League medal as well. But also another player that is a doubt for the final is Ahmadou Nourullahi, who is a box-to-box midfielder, but he's versatile. He can play in different roles. I thought he was brilliant against Al Sadd. He's a player that always puts in a shift, always works hard. He's disciplined tactically. He takes instruction as well. He's a doubt, so I'm not sure if he'll be playing. So replacing him could also be
an issue. But the main player for Persepolis for me is, well, the main combination, let's just say, is God, the Nigerian striker, Godwin Mensah, and Ali Alipur, both playing up front. And I think that's something that Persepolis will be threatening Kashima from, because they both will be working, and they are both really, really hard-working strikers. They will be putting the back four under pressure, and they're both very pacey as well. So on the counter, do not doubt that they'll be chasing every single ball to make sure that they can at least, you know, create half a chance if they have to.
Scott, feel free to add anything to what, you know, Sina mentioned. Just coming back to you, is it, if you could just tell us a little bit more about how you would expect Kashima Antlers to line up and set up formation, especially in the first leg. And also, a dear friend of the pod and somebody that she knows, Scott, very well, Martin Lowe, sent us a question. This is directed for you. Is what needs to occur in your opinions for the West to triumph over the East in the ACL final? And why is the alternative so clearly the case in the AFC Cup?
That's a discussion that we could take into well into the next day where we each are. So I'll touch on it in a minute. After, just quickly, I got a question. Firstly, I agree with Sina's assessment of Nur Elahi. I thought he was a fantastic player in the second leg, and of course Beverand made a, you know, collection of amazing saves to keep them in that tie as well. So two you know, really standout performances from that second leg. There's also a lot of injury concerns really at Kashima as well. I mean, they have several guys are out long term. One of their key Brazilians, Leandro, was injured early in the J League and hasn't played since then. And, you know, in recent weeks as well, they've lost another winger in Nakamura, the fullback. Atsuto Uchida, of course, was a long-term servant of the Japan national team, played in the Bundesliga for many years as well. He's out, but perhaps just as importantly is the guy that's often the captain of the team, Yasushi Endo, the right winger. He was injured recently as well and may not be right for the first leg. And then on top of all that, they have the guy that is the left winger, the young guy Abe, who's away with the Japan under-19 team. They just got through tonight to the semi-final, so I don't think he'll be back in time for certainly the first leg either. So if you look at the team that, you know, that would have gone, and this is of course leaving aside the fact that Naomichi Ueda, who was a World Cup defender, departed the Club of Europe midway through the year as well. So if you look at the team at the start of the year, you know, you could say probably half of that team has either moved on or is unavailable. And Mook Kanazaki was another one, actually, the striker who transferred to Tosu in the mid-season window here. also, so they have a lot of concerns to deal with there. The good news, though, is that, again, Shoji, another defender that was with Japan at the World Cup, but who's been out basically since that World Cup break, has just come back in the last couple of weeks. And so he'll line up in goal. I mean, they pretty much, you know, as you touched on in terms of Persepolis, are very rigid in the way that they line up tactically. It's a 4-4-2 with two wingers, two central and midfielders that do like to push forward. And then the two strikers are Serginho, the hero really of the semi-finals, has been a revelation. He's only come in midway through the season, kind of started slowly. It didn't really look like much of a player, to be honest, in the first couple of games. But you know, since then, he's really blossomed into a threatening play. But you know, as I said, this Brazilian mentality that runs through the club is one that, you know, they're not going to sit back, pretty much home or away. And you know, I mean, I don't think it's really going to bother them, the fact that you know, the second leg is away, because wherever they are, they're gonna attack. And then this is the philosophy and the mentality of the club, and it has been that way for a long time. I mean, you know, even the second leg of the semi final, they looked dead and buried, to be honest. There was seemingly no way back, but you know, they dug deep and they kept playing the way that they like to play, and you know, got those couple of goals that, you know, allied with a brilliant performance from the Korean goalkeeper Kun Sunte, who's was not really probably even a nailed-on first choice at the start of the season. He came across from John Book a couple of years ago, struggled to hold down regular starts, but he's been fantastic. Also, prone to occasional, you know, lapses and mistakes, but you know, when the big matches have been on the line, he's really stepped up and helped them. So, yeah, certainly injury concerns to deal with. On to Martin's question, though. This is this is a really difficult one, and we could talk about it for hours and hours. I mean, I've often been a proponent of this idea that it's very hard to flesh out in a small period of time. But basically, there's a rotating series of clubs. It's almost like what you see with the Nations League concept in a way, where you continually play games. I mean, you have to have an endpoint at some point. It might not even be annually. It might be biannually. I don't know. But under the way that I've kind of devised this thing is that the clubs that start from a certain nation don't necessarily hold their spots in it. So you must also maintain a domestic form to keep holding your spot in the continental space. This is a hell of a long theory. Maybe I'm going to write it down one day and we can discuss it over there. But outside of that, another thing that I'd like to see considered is that, you know, now we have this situation where we have to play home and away, I understand, because the crowds, you can't have a central location. But what I would like to see at least thought about is, say, from the knockout phase on, there's some form of points or some calculation that's devised, and we get to the point where the final is a one-off final, but it's hosted by the nation that has earned the most of these points, whatever things they are, you know, wins, goals scored, clean sheets, cards, whatever you want to throw into the mix and store it all around. So we come out with a one-off final, and it's hosted either in the East or West, but it's hosted by the nation that's earned it by getting there. So it means, you know, say, for example, you even have a 3-0 or 4-0 lead or something in the first leg, that you still need to go out and ensure you play your strongest team and you try and score goals or whatever the criteria is in the second leg to make sure that you keep, you know, picking up these points so that you then earn the right to host the final. So I think if it's put that way, there's an advantage, but it's an advantage that's an earned one. So, you know, we can't complain, okay, this team was here in the part of the season, this team was in their part of the season. You know, at least it gives clubs an incentive, you know, whatever point of the competition it started, to basically earn the right to host the final, which I think, you know, still should be a one-off final.
Sina, is there anything you would like? Because, I mean, there's another question that we have, that this question could also be like another episode for itself, but I'm really curious to hear what you have to add on to what Scott had to say before we talk about what you guys think about, you know, the results and everything.
He fell asleep due to my long and complicated explanation about assault. No,
I put myself on mute and then I forgot to take it off mute, so sorry. I think in terms of what Scott said, I think it's interesting. I mean, there's different theories, but I remember one thing that they did try, which on paper it did sound like a good idea, but it turned up, in reality, it turned out that it wasn't. I remember in the early 2000s, they tried to put a neutral venue for semifinals and the final. If I remember correctly, Scott can correct me if I'm wrong. But I remember, I think Tehran and Azadi Stadium was the host for the semifinal and final for 1 year, and Suwon in Korea were the hosts for the year after or the year before. And on paper, it sounds like a good idea. You know, the fans would know that their teams are going to be playing in one location. They could travel if they want to. But in reality, it turned out that it wasn't. And they've tried different things in the last couple of decades. But I'm not sure if there is, let's say, a right way of doing this. I think there will always be difficulty. There's not a perfect idea or perfect scenario, let's say. I think there will always be some negative points about any plan that they put into place in terms of the final, whether it's the one leg, two leg, or a neutral venue, or who gets to host it, and so on. So, and it's mostly because, of course, people compare it to Europe. Of course, it's incomparable to Europe because of many reasons that I don't think we have time to go into, but I would say for now, I think the two-legged final, it probably works for now. I think it's really important that fans are able to see their own teams. And I always think of Iran as a country, and football fans in Iran generally come from a working-class background, very poor backgrounds. They don't usually have the money to travel, let's say, to East Asia or even any other location to be able to watch their teams, and by fans, I'm talking about the ones who go to Azadi Stadium from all corners of Iran just to watch their team in the semi-final or even now the final. So I think it's really important to be able to reward those fans, and if it wasn't for those fans, and I'm sure there are more similar stories to Persepolis around Asia as well, but sometimes the passion of the fans and the way they support gets the team to where they are right now, and I have no doubt that kind of support has helped Persepolis in their journey to the final. So I think it's really important to be able to reward those fans and reward the support that they've given, and give them the chance to witness something so historical, especially for a club like Persepolis, as we mentioned. So I would say for that reason, I would agree with the current with the current scenario in place in terms of the two-legged final. But of course, we know with AFC and the plans, and we have to wait and see what happens in the future.
Two more questions for you guys before we wrap this preview up. Scott, what are your predictions, and what do you think is going to happen? I know you touched base on this. You believe that Kishima Antlers possibly will win, but we just want to know what you think is going to happen in these past two legs, and what should be our expectation?
It's just so hard to say. And just, going back to what Sina said, I was actually at one of these neutral venues. I think it was 2009 and 2010. They played them in Tokyo, actually, both of those finals. One of them was the now faded Korean side, Songnam Chunma. I think it was actually Zoba Han that they played in that final. And, they couldn't give tickets away for love nor money. I think the stadium was kind of half full. So I'm certainly against neutral venues as well. But I'm keen to flesh out my revolutionary idea of points and earning your way into the final. But it's a complicated situation also, because we look at the situation now where Kashima have been playing all these condensed matches due to the World Cup. The J-League had an extended break here, so the league fixtures were crushed either side of that. And as I said, they played just a truly stupid number of games. On the one hand, they're fit in terms of in form tactically. The team's at an advanced stage because of the point of the season we're at, compared that to the situation with Persepolis, where they haven't actually been playing for too long in their domestic campaign. So you think okay, maybe it's going to suit Kashima, but then maybe the other element, I don't know, it's going to suit Persepolis, because the wear and the tear is not so much there in the squad. We've seen the injuries that have come as a result of that for Kashima. And then the fact that the two legs of these are only a week apart, right? It's this weekend and then the following weekend. Is that correct?
Yes, that's right. Yes.
So I mean, also, I don't know, and I don't know the plans of Kashima, but often money's not so much of an impact for these teams. I don't know the plans for Persepolis either, but it wouldn't be beyond the pale, for example, if there were at least talks or a consideration given from the J-League, perhaps to support Kashima in terms of, how they actually get across into Iran. We've seen other, wealthy kind of nations in Asia do this in the past, where they've chartered, flights and kind of kitted them out with rehab and medical facilities. So, this is certainly an option that if Kashima were to consider it, I'm sure wouldn't be, totally beyond the economic realities of the situation. So often, it's what goes on in the background. You touched earlier, with the conditioning staff and the medical staff, these guys are really the unsung heroes of often these kind of tournaments, where we've had the whole tournament stretched out since the beginning of February, when the qualifiers were happening, and now here we are, and for some reason I don't quite know why, crushing the actual final into a space of 7 days. It doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. I'm sure there's a reason behind exactly why it's happening. Maybe it's another argument as to why there should only be one leg. But I think with all those things considered, the resources that are potentially available to Kashima, should they use them, the fact that I really expect them to go harder during the first leg, they have dangerous threats in front of goal that are in good form domestically. They're in good form on the continent. They would have taken a hell of a lot of confidence from the way that they fought back to progress against Suwon. And like I said, they're almost fearless wherever they are. And even if they're, say they get a goal or two up, I don't think they're going to necessarily sit and look to try and contain. You can almost see them, pushing on and trying to really make sure that they seal it as much as they can in that first leg. And equally, we saw the first leg, there were a couple of goals down. They fought back to 3-2, two away goals for Suwon. You think, they might be in trouble, but they went there and they played positively in Korea as well. So even if disaster did strike in the first leg, I don't think we could rule them out in that circumstance either. So I think, with all these things, and obviously I profess to knowing a lot more about Kashima than I do about Persepolis, but for mine, I think that we have to say the favoritism lies at this point with Kashima both on the field, perhaps also off the field. Maybe Pasha or Sila, you know the travel arrangements with Persepolis when they're actually getting into Japan in terms of were domestic fixtures are postponed, anything like this?
Well, going back to the semi-final, I think they had the game postponed prior to the second leg. I'm not 100% sure who they were playing, but I do remember a game being postponed to a later date. And they do have a game between the two legs of the final. I think, as far as I know, they are currently in talks with the league and the opposition team to postpone the game to a later date. But whether they will succeed or not is a different question. And if I remember correctly, they're either playing Zobahan or Sepahan, which will be a big and very heavy game. They're not easy opposition to play against. So we'll just have to wait and see what happens in that as well. I mean, we're talking about Iran. It could be a matter of the day before the game. They say, "Oh, the game is postponed," and we've agreed on something. So it's really hard to predict from now. But as far as I know, they would like to postpone the game, but I'm not sure if there's been any confirmation in terms of the game actually being agreed to be postponed or not.
Sino, what are your predictions, and how do you think Bronco is going to set up his team?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I think Persepolis are very predictive in the way they will line up formation-wise. And, as I said, having so many, especially when it comes to the defensive side, having people out with injuries, it's out of his hands who plays where. I mean, the way they lined up against Al Sadd in the second leg, with Shereh Khalilzadeh at right back and Shoaib Muslah at left back with Ansari and Hosseini in the middle, I think that's probably what he will go with as well. Although I still have my doubts in terms of Khalilzadeh playing right back. I mean, in the first leg against Al Sadd away from home, he played Siomaki Nemati, the man who scored the goal in the second leg. He was playing right back in the first leg, out of position. So I wonder if that's something that he would consider as well. But in terms of shape and formation, it will be a narrow diamond in the middle with two strikers. So again, it comes down to how Kashima will approach this game. And of course, we know the goal scoring record of Kashima and the fantastic scoreline in both legs in the east side between them and was it Swan Samsung?
Swan, yeah.
Yes. So you know they will be able to score. You know they have the potency to score. So maybe that makes it easier for Persepolis to know that all they have to do is just defend like the case I've said, and try and hope that there will be defensive weaknesses in the Kashima back four that they can exploit. But the important thing for me is how will he? What kind of instructions will he give the midfield four? Will they be supporting the fullbacks, or will they just be making sure that no balls go through in the middle and try and push the other team wide? So again, it's one of those things we'll just have to wait and see. But it's so important for Persepolis to make sure that they are in the tie before the second leg in Azadi. So I don't think they will be aiming for anything other than a draw at best away in Japan. But just a quick question that I've got for Scott as well. This is the second year in a row that we have a Japanese finalist, with, of course, Urawa Reds winning it last year. I don't want to say if Japanese clubs are on the rise, because of course they've always been one of some of the biggest clubs in Asia. But I would like to take it back to China and say what's happened to the Chinese clubs, because for a few years after the 2010s they were qualifying for the semi final and final quite regularly. So what's happened with the Chinese clubs? I mean, we didn't even have a semi-finalist this year. So why the sudden decline in the Chinese clubs? And is that partly why the Japanese clubs have been able to reach the final twice in 2 years now?
I guess it's probably worth pointing out that this was, a renaissance in a way for Japanese football, because they hadn't, prior to that, made the final, I think it was almost 8 or 9 years since Gumbra had won it, since they'd actually had a nation in the final. And if we look at China, I mean, really, we need to actually say it's basically Guangzhou, right? I mean, they were the team that were in those finals. That they were the team that were consistently making it through. There were other teams, you know, that did get out of the group stage, but never, you know, really looked like going as far as Guangzhou. And this year, for the first time in almost a decade, basically as well, you know, their domestic control has been under threat. There's a lot of issues going on in Chinese football with you know, regulations designed to curb you know, big name foreigners coming in, and then the promotion of youth, and this year they introduced this rather complicated system where if you wanted to have a foreign player on the pitch, you needed to have a Chinese national who was an under 23 player on at the same time, which meant you need an advanced degree in mathematics to make your match day substitutions, and all these kind of things, I think, combined to bring ever so slightly Guangzhou back to the pack domestically. And I think, you know, we've perhaps seen the flow on impact of that in terms of the ACL, and we might see it in terms of years to come as well. For some reason, that you know, whoever's making the decisions in China, the government or the football association or owners or the clubs, but you know, some of these things are really kind of head scratching. What's going on? And I don't know if you know, just a couple of weeks ago, again, we don't know quite who made the decision, but it was obviously someone quite powerful. They decided, for reasons that totally, in my opinion, illogical, with the four matches to go in the end of the season, they called up a training camp of, again, it's quite unusual, an under 25 national team, which I've never heard of, and they plucked almost 40 players out of these clubs. I mean, unilaterally, the clubs had no say. They had to release these players, and they shipped them off to a kind of military army style boot camp, you know, way off in the Chinese mountains, and made them shave their heads and go through all this kind of ridiculous thing. So there's a whole host of problems going on domestically in China. I think that was probably part of the reason why, you know, we didn't see one of the teams make it to the final this year. And, you know, if this kind of nonsense continues, it might be, you know, a hell of a long time until we see them back there again.
Guys, last point, predictions for this first leg. I'm going to come off with Cena, would you?
It's difficult. This is the part I'm really, really not good at. And I don't want to at all. But I think it's hard for Persepolis to keep a clean sheet away from home, considering that all the things we discussed in terms of Kashima's goal-scoring record. But I also think they do have what it takes on the counter, and they do have the pace to hurt Kashima. So I'm kind of hopeful, and I will go for a 1-0 draw for the first leg.
Scott, if you could give us your predictions, and there's a question for you from Nima Asadi at Nima 18. He's asking if you think the current format makes sense for the Asian Champions League, and he was mentioning, I understand the issue with the distance between the countries, but isn't there a better solution? Like, what if the East and the West meet in quarterfinals instead of the final? Which could be another episode in itself, but if you could just briefly touch base on that, we'll appreciate it.
Yeah, I mean, I can't give you any kind of guarantee prediction with any form of, you know, assurance, because otherwise I'd be living, you know, the life in the Maldives or somewhere rather than doing podcasts on Asian football. But I just think the potential scoring ability of Kashima is going to override the potential defensive control and organisation of Persepolis. And I think if Kashima get a goal early, they're going to put their foot down and really go for it. And I don't know, in that situation, how Persepolis are likely to respond. I mean, you know, there comes a point where you must look to stem the flow and stem the damage, but in a way that only plays more into Kashima's hands, and maybe there should be a temptation to try and see what you can do, and if you can pick up an away goal. But I think there are defensive frailties for Kashima, I agree, but with Choji back, you now have a Japanese international alongside Jung, the Korean international in central defence. Daigo Nishi, the right back, has been a fantastic scorer of goals in recent times. He's not really the kind of fullback that you know, bombs up and down, but he does it enough to really make his presence felt when he is in the attacking third, and he's created a lot of goals, and he's actually scored a lot domestically and in the ACL as well at crucial points. And they also have a similar kind of player in Yamamoto Shuto on the other side of the pitch. So I think, you know, right across the pitch, even with the players that they're missing, this is a very strong Kashima side, and I think they're going to be too good, and I think they'll win the first leg by a couple of goals, although they wouldn't be on, you know, conceding one as well. So let's say 3-1. In terms of, yeah, the East and West, I mean, the same issues that we have with the final are the issues that we have with the group stage. And again, I've mentioned this, kind of floated it as an idea in the past. I don't know how it works in terms of, you know, marrying up the times and points of the season and the various climates across the region. But and again, how you're going to squeeze it into the calendar. But I wouldn't mind the idea of almost looking to have, as you do with international match days, the FIFA match days, to have ACL match days as well, continental match days. And that would require, you know, obviously the cooperation of 47 different people with different political interests and so on. But, I mean, if you had, say, even three of these days where all the leagues across Asia agreed to postpone the leagues for these times, and then you in essence play three round robin style of matches, so you have them whether they can be, I don't know, at a centralized location or whether they can be for some reason hosted in one of the teams on merit or rotated or something or other, and then you play, you know, each team maybe plays a two or three matches during these, say, two matches on three windows, and you've got your group stage kind of done there, where all the leagues are shut down. What it also does is it avoids the conflict of interest that we've seen, as I touched on earlier, with Cerezo and other clubs across Asia not sending their full strength team, you know, to kind of hold them back for domestic matches. You wouldn't have that excuse anymore, because the domestic league would be in hiatus anyway. It would you know, promote surely the TV rights of the product as well, if everyone knew that there was no competition for you know, for league fixtures, and all the eyes and dollars and whatever else can be focused on these group stage matches. I think it's certainly something that, yeah, the AFC should probably look at. But you know, they've got much smarter people than us in there trying to sort all these things out. So I'm sure they'll come up with something going forward.
Scott, thank you again so much for your time. I know it's like close to like 1 a.m. over there, and Sina, you as well. And if there's any last things, obviously we're going to do an analysis post these matches. But Scott, just a quick thing. If you could, I mean, I subscribe to this. Such a fantastic podcast. And as you know, we just focus on, you know, Asian football, but just specifically on Iranian football. The work you guys are doing, you guys are giving the whole well-rounded community of Asian football. And if you could just talk in a little bit in brief about the work you guys are doing, if people haven't listened, which they definitely should, about the Asian games.
Yeah, so just, yeah, myself and Paul decided that, you know, after talking about it for quite a while, we wanted to do something. It's obviously ambitious because, you know, he's in Australia, I'm in Japan, so we know our own leagues well. And, you know, I travel quite a bit, so I know a little about a lot. But, you know, we lean on a lot of people to fill in, you know, that lot about a little. And that's what we're trying to do, you know, tell the stories of not just the big nations and players in Asia, but, you know, a lot of the smaller ones as well. And yeah, you know, for us it's a great thrill to be able to do it, because we're learning, you know, a lot about you know, leagues and clubs and players that we didn't know about as well, and just trying to share those stories with people. So we'd love to have, yeah, as many people along for the ride as possible. So you can get it where you get all the, you know, the podcast from the usual sources, the Asian game.
Yeah, and the link and everything will be up on the website and everything. Sina, thank you so much. I know it's like you're trying to go watch United 2 right now, probably. So
I've got better things to do, Pasha.
All right, thank you, gents. I appreciate it.
Thank you, guys. Pleasure as always.
Yeah, pleasure.